He retired to Sheen Lodge, where Alice, after the modern fashion, encouraged him to dwell on tournaments, the chase, and wide plans when he should recover. But hostile chroniclers have it that, when the stupor preceding death engulfed the king, she took the rings from his fingers and other movable property in the house, and departed for some time to extreme privacy. We have not heard her tale, but her reappearance in somewhat buoyant situations in the new reign seems to show that she had one to tell. All accounts, alas, confirm that King Edward died deserted by all, and that only the charity of a local priest procured him the protection and warrant of the church in his final expedition. The Black Prince's son was recognised as king by general assent on the very day his grandfather died, no question of election being raised, and the crown of England passed to a minor. Book 3. The End of the Feudal Age. Chapter 1. King Richard II and the Social Revolt. John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, younger brother of the Black Prince, uncle of the King, was head of the Council of Regency and ruled the land. Both the impact and the shadow of the Black Death dominated the scene. A new fluidity swept English society. The pang of almost mortal injury still throbbed, but with it crept a feeling that there was, for the moment, more room in the land. A multitude of vacant places had just been filled, and many men in all classes had the sense of unexpected promotion and enlargement about them. A community had been profoundly deranged, reduced in collective strength, but often individually lifted. The belief that the English were invincible and supreme in war, that nothing could stand before their arms, was ingrained. The elation of Crecy and Poitiers survived the loss of many material gains in France. The assurance of being able to meet the French or the Scots at any time upon the battlefield overrode inquiries about the upshot of the war. Few recognised the difference between winning battles and making lasting conquests. Parliament in its youth was eager for war, improvident in preparation, and resentful in paying for it. While the war continued, the Crown was expected to produce dazzling results, and at the same time was censured for the burden of taxation and annoyance to the realm. A peace approached inexorably, which would in no way correspond to the sensation of overwhelming victory in which the English indulged themselves. This ugly prospect came to Richard II as a prominent part of his inheritance. In the economic and social sphere, there arose a vast tumult. The Black Death had struck a world already in movement. Ever since the Crown had introduced the custom of employing wage-earning soldiers instead of the feudal levy, the landed tie had been dissolving. Why should not the noble or knight follow the example of his liege lord? Covenants, in which a small landowner undertook to serve a powerful neighbour, except against the king, became common. The restriction would not always be observed. The old bonds of mutual loyalty were disappearing, and in their place grew private armies, the hired defenders of property, the sure precursors of anarchy. In medieval England, the lords of the manors had often based their prosperity on a serf peasantry, whose status and duties were enjoined by long custom and enforced by manorial courts. Around each manor, a closely bound and self-sufficient community revolved. Although there had been more movement of labour and interchange of goods in the 13th and early 14th centuries than was formerly supposed, development had been relatively slow, and the break-up of the village community gradual. The time had now come when the compartments of society and toil could no longer preserve their structure. The convulsion of the Black Death violently accelerated this deep and rending process. Nearly one-third of the population being suddenly dead, a large part of the land passed out of cultivation. The survivors turned their ploughs to the richest soils and quartered their flocks and herds on the fairest pastures. Many landowners abandoned ploughs and enclosed, often by encroachment, the best grazing. At this time, when wealth-getting seemed easier and both prices and profits ran high, the available labour was reduced by nearly a half. Small holdings were deserted, and many manors were denuded of the peasantry who served them from time immemorial. Ploughmen and labourers found themselves in high demand and were competed for on all sides. They, in their turn, sought to better themselves, or at least to keep their living equal with the rising prices. The poet Langland gives an unsympathetic but interesting picture in Piers Ploughman. "Labourers that have no land, to live on but their hands, deigned not to dine a day on night-old warts. May no penny ale him pay, nor a piece of bacon, but it be fresh flesh or fish, fried or baked, and that showed and plue-showed for chilling of their maw, but he be highly hired, else will he chide." But their masters saw differently. They repulsed fiercely demands for increased wages. They revived ancient claims to forced or tied labour. The pedigrees of villagers were scrutinised with a care hitherto only bestowed upon persons of quality. The villeins, who were declared serfs, were at least free from new claims. Assertions of long-lapsed authority, however good in law, were violently resisted by the country folk. They formed unions of labourers to guard their interests. There were escapes of villeins from the estates, like those of the slaves from the southern states of America in the 1850s. Some landlords, in their embarrassment, offered to commute the labour services, they claimed, and to procure obedience by granting leases to smallholders. On some manors, the serfs were enfranchised in a body, and a class of free tenants came into being. But this feature was rare. The greatest of all landlords was the church. On the whole, the spiritual power stood up successfully against the assault of this part of its flock. When a landlord was driven, as was the abbot of Battle on the manor of Hutton, to lease vacant holdings, this was done on the shortest terms, which at the first tactical opportunity were reduced to a yearly basis. A similar attempt in 18th century France to revive obsolete feudal claims aroused the spirit of revolution. The turmoil through which all England passed affected the daily life of the mass of the people in a manner not seen again in our social history till the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. Here was a case in which a parliament, based upon property, could have a decided opinion. In England, as in France, the Crown had more than once in the past interfered with the local regulation of wages, but the Statute of Labourers, 1351, was the first important attempt to fix wages and prices for the country as a whole. In the aggravated conditions following the pestilence, Parliament sought to enforce these laws as fully as it dared. Honorary justices of labour, drawn from the rural middle classes and with fixed salaries, were appointed to try offenders. Between 1351 and 1377, 9,000 cases of breach of contract were tried before the Common Pleas. In many parts, the commissioners, who were active and biased, were attacked by the inhabitants. Unrest spread wide and deep. Still, on the morrow of the plague, there was an undoubted well-being among the survivors. Says Froissart, "The peasants' rebellion was caused and incited by the great ease and plenty in which the meaner folk of England lived." The people were not without the means of protesting against injustice, nor without the voice to express their discontent. Among the lower clergy, the clerks with small benefices had been severely smitten by the Black Death. In East Anglia alone, 800 priests had died. The survivors found that their stipends remained unaltered in a world of rising prices, and that the higher clergy were completely indifferent to this problem of the ecclesiastical proletarian. For this, atonement was to be exacted. The episcopal manors were marked places of attack in the rising. At the fairs on market day, agitators, especially among the friars, collected and stirred crowds. Langland voiced the indignation of the established order against these Christian communists. "They preach men of Plato and prove it by Seneca, that all things under heaven ought to be in common. And yet he lies, as I live, that to the unlearned so preacheth." Many vehement agitators, among whom John Ball is the best known, gave forth a stream of subversive doctrine. The country was full of broken soldiers, disbanded from the war, and all knew about the longbow and its power to kill nobles, however exalted and well-armed. The preaching of revolutionary ideas was widespread, and a popular ballad expressed the response of the masses. When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then a gentleman? This was a novel question for the 14th century, and awkward at any time. The rigid, time-enforced framework of medieval England trembled to its foundations. These conditions were by no means confined to the island. Across the Channel, a radical and democratic movement with talk much akin to that of our own time was afoot. In England, all rolled forward to the terrifying rebellion of 1381. It was a social upheaval, spontaneous and widespread, arising in various parts of the country from the same causes and united by the same sentiments. That all this movement was the direct consequence of the Black Death is proved by the fact that the revolt was most fierce in those very districts of Kent and the East Midlands where the death rate had been highest, and the derangement of custom the most violent. It was a cry of pain and anger from a generation shaken out of submissiveness by changes in their lot, which gave rise alike to new hope and new injustice. Throughout the summer of 1381, there was a general ferment. Beneath it all lay organization. Agents moved round the villages of central England in touch with a great society which was said to meet in London. In May, violence broke out in Essex. It was started by an attempt to make a second and more stringent collection of the poll tax which had been levied in the previous year. The turbulent elements in London took fire, and a band under one Thomas Farringdon marched off to join the rebels. Walworth, the mayor, faced a strong municipal opposition which was in sympathy and contact with the rising. In Kent, after an attack on Lesness Abbey, the peasants marched through Rochester and Maidstone, burning manorial and taxation records on their way. At Maidstone, they released the agitator John Ball from the Episcopal prison, and were joined by a military adventurer with gifts and experience of leadership, Wat Tyler. The Royal Council was bewildered and inactive. Early in June, the main body of rebels from Essex and Kent moved on London. Here they found support. John Horne, fishmonger, invited them to enter. The alderman in charge of London Bridge did nothing to defend it, and Aldgate was opened treacherously to a band of Essex rioters. For 3 days, the city was in confusion. Foreigners were murdered. 2 members of the council, Simon Sudbury, the Archbishop of Canterbury and Chancellor, and Sir Robert Hales, the Treasurer, were dragged from the Tower and beheaded on Tower Hill. The Savoy Palace of John of Gaunt was burnt. Lambeth and Southwark were sacked. This was the time for paying off of old scores. Farringdon had drawn up proscription lists, and the extortionate financier Richard Lyons was killed. All this has a modern ring. But the loyal citizen body rallied round the mayor, and at Smithfield the young king faced the rebel leaders. Among the insurgents there seemed to have been a general loyalty to the sovereign. Their demands were reasonable but disconcerting. They asked for the repeal of oppressive statutes, for the abolition of villeinage, and for the division of church property. In particular, they asserted that no man ought to be a serf or do labour services to a seigneur, but pay 4 pence an acre a year for his land, and not have to serve any man against his will, but only by agreement. While the parley was going on, Tyler was first wounded by Mayor Walworth, and then smitten to death by one of the king's esquires. As the rebel leader rolled off his horse, dead in the sight of the great assembly, the king met the crisis by riding forward alone with the cry, "I will be your leader. You shall have from me all ye seek. Only follow me to the fields outside." But the death of Tyler proved a signal for a wave of reaction. The leaderless bands wandered home and spread a vulgar lawlessness through their counties. They were pursued by reconstructed authority. Vengeance was wreaked. The rising had spread throughout the southwest. There were riots in Bridgewater, Winchester, and Salisbury. In Hertfordshire, the peasants rose against the powerful and hated Abbey of St. Albans and marched on London under Jack Straw. There was a general revolt in Cambridgeshire, accompanied by burning of rolls and attacks on episcopal manors. The Abbey of Ramsey in Huntingdonshire was attacked, though the burghers of Huntingdon shut their gates against the rioters. In Norfolk and Suffolk, where the peasants were richer and more independent, the irritation against legal villainage was stronger. The Abbey of Bury St. Edmunds was a prominent object of hatred, and the Flemish woolen craftsmen were murdered in Lynn. Waves of revolt rippled on as far north as Yorkshire and Cheshire, and to the west in Wiltshire and Somerset. But after Tyler's death, the resistance of the ruling classes was organised. Letters were sent out from Chancery to the royal officials commanding the restoration of order, and justices, under Chief Justice Tresilian, gave swift judgment upon insurgents. The king, who accompanied Tresilian on the punitive circuit, pressed for the observance of legal forms in the punishment of rebels. The warlike Bishop Le Despenser of Norwich used armed force in the eastern counties in defence of church property, and a veritable battle was fought at North Walsham. Nevertheless, the reaction was, according to modern examples, very restrained. Not more than 150 executions are recorded in the rolls. There was nothing like the savagery we've seen in many parts of Europe in our own times. Law re-established, ruled by law. Even in this furious class reaction, no men were hanged except after trial by jury. In January 1382, a general amnesty suggested by Parliament was proclaimed. But the victory of property was won, and there followed the unanimous annulment of all concessions and a bold attempt to recreate intact the manorial system of the early part of the century. Yet for generations, the upper classes lived in fear of a popular rising, and the labourers continued to combine. Servile labour ceased to be the basis of the system. The legal aspect of serfdom became of little importance, and the development of commutation went on, speaking broadly, at an accelerated pace after 1349. Such were the more enduring legacies of the Black Death. The revolt, which to the historian is but a sudden flash of revealing light on medieval conditions among the poorer classes, struck with lasting awe the imagination of its contemporaries. It left a hard core of bitterness among the peasantry, and called forth a vigorous and watchful resistance from authority. Henceforth, a fixed desire for the division of ecclesiastical property was conceived. The spread of Lollardy, after the revolt, drew upon it the hostility of the intimidated victors. Wycliffe's poor preachers bore the stigma of having fomented the troubles, and their persecution was the revenge of a shaken system. In the charged, sullen atmosphere of the England of the 1380s, Wycliffe's doctrines gathered wide momentum. But faced by social revolution, English society was in no mood for church reform. All subversive doctrines fell under censure, and although Wycliffe was not directly responsible or accused of seditious preaching, the result was disastrous to his cause. The landed classes gave silent assent to the ultimate suppression of the preacher by the church. This descended swiftly and effectively. Wycliffe's old opponent, Courtney, had become archbishop after Sudbury's murder. He found Wycliffe's friends in control of Oxford. He acted with speed. The doctrines of the reformer were officially condemned. The bishops were instructed to arrest all unlicensed preachers, and the archbishop himself rapidly became the head of a system of church discipline. And this, with the active support of the state in Lancastrian days, eventually enabled the church to recover from the attack of the laity. In 1382, Courtney descended upon Oxford and held a convocation in the chapter house of what is now Christ Church. The chief Lollards were sharply summoned to recant. The Chancellor's protest of university privilege was brushed aside. Hard censure fell upon Wycliffe's followers. They blenched and bowed. Wycliffe found himself alone. His attack on church doctrine, as distinct from church privilege, had lost him the support of Gaunt. His popular preachers and the beginnings of English Bible reading could not build a solid party against the dominant social forces. Wycliffe, who died in 1384, had appealed to the conscience of his age. Baffled, though not silenced in England, his inspiration stirred a distant and little-known land, and thence disturbed Europe. Students from Prague had come to Oxford and carried his doctrines, and indeed the manuscripts of his writings, to Bohemia. From this sprang the movement by which the fame of John Huss eclipsed that of his English master and evoked the enduring national consciousness of the Czech people. By his frontal attack on the Church's absolute authority over men in this world, by his implication of the supremacy of the individual conscience, and by his challenge to ecclesiastical dogma, Wycliffe had called down upon himself the thunderbolts of repression. But his protest had led to the first of the Oxford movements. The cause, lost in his day, impelled the tide of the Reformation. Lollardy, as the Wycliffe movement came to be called, was driven beneath the surface. The Church, strengthening its temporal position by alliance with the state, brazenly repelled the first assault. But its spiritual authority bore henceforward the scars and enfeeblement resulting from the conflict. Fuller, the 17th-century writer, wrote of Wycliffe's preachers, "These men were sentinels against an army of enemies until God sent Luther to relieve them." In Oxford, Wycliffeite tradition lingered in Bible study until the Reformation. In the country, Lollardy became identified with political sedition, though this was not what Wycliffe had taught. Its ecclesiastical opponents were eager to make the charge, and the passionate, sometimes ignorant invective of the Lollard preachers, often laymen, supplied a wealth of evidence. Cruel days lay ahead. The political tradition was to be burned out in the misery of Sir John Oldcastle's rebellion under Henry V. But a vital element of resistance to the formation of a militant and triumphant church survived in the English people. A principle had been implanted in English hearts which shaped the destiny of the race. Wycliffe's failure in his own day was total, and the ray of his star faded in the light of the Reformation dawn. "Wycliffe," wrote Milton in Areopagitica, "was a man who wanted, to render his learning consummate, nothing but his living in a happier age." The stubborn wish for practical freedom was not broken in England, and the status and temper of the people stand in favourable contrast to the exhausted passivity of the French peasant, bludgeoned to submission by war, famine, and the brutal suppression of the so-called Jacquerie. "It is cowardice and lack of hearts and courage," wrote Sir John Fortescue, the eminent jurist of Henry VI's reign, "that keepeth the Frenchman from rising, and not poverty, which courage no Frenchman hath like to the Englishman." The king was now growing up. His keen instincts and precocious abilities were sharpened by all that he'd seen and done. In the crisis of the peasants' revolt, the brunt of many things had fallen upon him, and by his personal action he'd saved the situation on a memorable occasion. It was the king's court and the royal judges who'd restored order when the feudal class had lost their nerve. Yet the king consented to a prolonged tutelage. John of Gaunt, viceroy of Aquitaine, quitted the realm to pursue abroad interests which included personal claims to the kingdom of Castile. He left behind him his son, Henry Bolingbroke, a vigorous and capable youth, to take charge of his English estates and interests. It was not till he was 20 that Richard determined to be complete master of his council, and in particular to escape from the control of his uncles. No king had been treated in such a way before. His grandfather had been obeyed when he was 18. Richard, at 14, had played decisive parts. His household and the court around it were deeply interested in his assumption of power. This circle comprised the brains of the government and the high civil service. Its chiefs were the Chancellor, Michael de la Pole, Chief Justice Trezilian, and Alexander Neville, Archbishop of York. Behind them, Simon Burley, Richard's tutor and close intimate, was probably the guide. A group of younger nobles threw in their fortunes with the court. Of these, the head was Robert de Vere, Earl of Oxford, who now played a part resembling that of Gaveston under Edward II. The king, the fountain of honour, spread his favours among his adherents, and de Vere was soon created Duke of Ireland. This was plainly a political challenge to the magnates of the council. Ireland was a reservoir of men and supplies beyond the control of Parliament and the nobility, which could be used for the mastery of England. The accumulation of household and government offices by the clique around the king and his effeminate favourite affronted the feudal party, and to some extent the national spirit. As so often happens, the opposition found in foreign affairs a vehicle of attack. Lack of money, fear of asking for it, and above all no military leadership had led the court to pacific courses. The nobility were at one with the Parliament in decrying the unmarshalled Chancellor Pole and the lush hedonism of the court. They were, they jeered, rather knights of Venus than of Bellona. War must be waged with France. And on this theme, in 1386, a coherent front was formed against the Crown. Parliament was led to appoint a commission of 5 ministers and 9 lords, of whom the former councillors of regency were the chiefs. The court bent before the storm of Pole's impeachment. A purge of the civil service, supposed to be the source alike of the king's errors and of his strength, was instituted. And we may note that Geoffrey Chaucer, his equerry, but famous for other reasons, lost his 2 posts in the customs. When the commissioners presently compelled the king to dismiss his personal friends, Richard, in deep distress, withdrew from London. In North Wales, he consorted with the new Duke of Ireland, at York with Archbishop Neville, and at Nottingham with Chief Justice Trezilian. He sought to marshal his forces for civil war, at the very same spot where Charles I would one day unfurl the royal standard. Irish levies, Welsh pikemen, and above all, Cheshire archers from his own earldom were gathering to form an army. Upon this basis of force, Trezilian and 4 other royal judges pronounced that the pressure put upon him by the Lords Appellant, as they were now styled, and the Parliament, was contrary to the laws and constitution of England. This judgment, the legal soundness of which is undoubted, was followed by a bloody reprisal. The king's uncle, Gloucester, together with other heads of the baronial oligarchy, denounced the Chief Justice and those who had acted with him, including De Vere and the other royal advisers, as traitors to the realm. The king, he was but 20, had based himself too bluntly upon his royal authority. The lords of the council were still able to command the support of Parliament. Moreover, they resorted to arms. Gloucester, with an armed power, approached London. Richard, arriving there first, was welcomed by the people. They displayed his red and white colours and showed attachment to his person, but they were not prepared to fight the advancing baronial army. In Westminster Hall, the 3 principal Lords Appellant, Gloucester, Arundel and Warwick, with an escort outside of 300 horsemen, bullied the king into submission. He could do no more than secure the escape of his supporters. De Vere retired to Chester and raised an armed force to secure the royal rights. With this, in December 1387, he marched towards London. But now appeared in arms the Lord's Appellant, and also Gaunt's son, Henry. At Radcot Bridge, in Oxfordshire, Henry and they defeated and broke De Vere. The favourite fled overseas. The king was now at the mercy of the proud faction which had usurped the rights of the monarchy. They disputed long among themselves whether or not he should be deposed and killed. The older men were for the extreme course. The younger restrained them. Richard was brutally threatened with the fate of his great-grandfather, Edward II. So severe was the discussion that only 2 of the Lords Appellant consented to remain with him for supper. It was Henry, the young military victor, who pleaded for moderation, possibly because his father's claim to the throne would have been overridden by the substitution of Gloucester for Richard. The Lords Appellant, divided as they were, shrank from deposing and killing the king, but they drew the line at nothing else. They forced him to yield at every point. Cruel was the vengeance that they wreaked upon the upstart nobility of his circle and his legal adherents. The estates of the realm were summoned to give countenance to the new regime. On the appointed day, the 5 Lords Appellant, in golden clothes, entered Westminster Hall arm in arm. The merciless Parliament opened its session. the most obnoxious opponents were the royal judges, headed by Trezillian. He'd promulgated at Nottingham the doctrine of the royal supremacy, with its courts and lawyers, over the nobles who held Parliament in their hand. To this a sombre answer was now made, which, though, as so often before, it asserted the fact of feudal power, also proclaimed the principle of parliamentary control. The fact vanished in the turbulence of those days, but the principle echoed down into the 17th century. Chief Justice Trezillian and four of the other persons responsible for the Nottingham Declaration were hanged, drawn, and quartered at Tyburn. The royal tutor, Burley, was not spared. The victory of the old nobility was complete. Only the person of the king was respected, and that by the narrowest of margins. Richard, forced not only to submit, but to assent to the slaughter of his friends, buried himself as low as he could in retirement. We must suppose that this treatment produced a marked impression upon his mind. It falls to the lot of few mortals to endure such ordeals. He brooded upon his wrongs, and also upon his past mistakes. He saw in the triumphant lords men who would be tyrants not only over the king, but over the people. He laid his plans for revenge and for his own rights with far more craft than before. For a year there was a sinister lull. On May the 3rd, 1389, Richard took action which none of them had foreseen. Taking his seat at the council, he asked blandly to be told how old he was. On being answered that he was 23, he declared that he'd certainly come of age, and that he would no longer submit to restrictions upon his rights, which none of his subjects would endure. He would manage the realm himself. He would choose his own advisers. He would be king, indeed. This stroke had no doubt been prepared with the uncanny and abnormal cleverness which marked many of Richard's schemes. It was immediately successful. Bishop Thomas, the Earl of Arundel's brother and later Archbishop of Canterbury, surrendered the Great Seal at his demand. Bishop Gilbert quitted the Treasury, and the King's sympathisers, William of Wickham and Thomas Bruntingham, were restored to their posts as Chancellor and Treasurer. King's nominees were added to those of the appellants on the judicial bench. Letters from the King to the sheriffs announced that he'd assumed the government, and the news was accepted by the public with an unexpected measure of welcome. Richard used his victory with prudence and mercy. In October 1389, John of Gaunt returned from Spain, and his son, Henry, now a leading personage, was reconciled to the King. The terrible combination of 1388 had dissolved. The machinery of royal government, triumphant over faction, resumed its sway, and for the next 8 years Richard governed England in the guise of a constitutional and popular king. This was an age in which the masses were totally excluded from power, and when the ruling classes, including the new middle class, even in their most deadly quarrels, all was united to keep them down. Richard has been judged, and his record declared by the socially powerful elements which overthrew him. But their verdict upon his character can only be accepted under reserve. That he sought to subvert and annul the constitutional rights which the rivalries of factions and of church and baronage had unconsciously but resolutely built up cannot be denied. But whether this was for purposes of personal satisfaction, or in the hope of fulfilling the pledge which he'd made in the crisis of the peasants' revolts, "I will be your leader," is a question not to be incontinently brushed aside. It is true that to one deputation of rebels in 1381 he testily replied, "Villeins ye are still, and villeins ye shall remain," adding that pledges made under duress went for nothing. Yet by letters patent he freed many peasants from their feudal bonds. He'd solemnly promised the abolition of serfdom. He proposed it to Parliament. He'd been overruled. He had a long memory for injuries. Perhaps also it extended to his obligations. The patience and skill with which Richard accomplished his revenge are most striking. For 8 years he tolerated the presence of Arundel and Gloucester, not, as before, as the governors of the country, but still in high positions. There were moments when his passion flared. In 1394, when Arundel was late for the funeral of the Queen, Anne of Bohemia, and the whole procession was delayed, he snatched a steward's wand, struck him in the face, and drew blood. The clergy raised a cry that the Church of Westminster had been polluted. Men raked up an old prophecy that God's punishment for the murder of Thomas Becket would not be exacted from the nation until blood was shed in that sacred nave. Yet after a few weeks, we see the king apparently reconciled to Arundel, and all proceeding under a glittering mask. While the lords were at variance, the king sought to strengthen himself by gathering Irish resources. In 1394, he went with all the formality of a royal progress to Ireland, and for this purpose created an army dependent upon himself, which was to be useful later in overawing opposition in England. When he returned, his plans for subduing both the baronage and the estates to his authority were far advanced. To free himself from the burden of war, which would make him directly dependent upon the favours of Parliament, he made a settlement with France. After the death of his first wife, Anne, he'd married in 1396 the child Isabel, daughter of Charles VI of France. Upon this, a truce or pact of amity and non-aggression for 30 years was concluded. A secret clause laid down that if Richard were in future to be menaced by any of his subjects, the King of France would come to his aid. Although the terms of peace were the subject of complaint, the king gained immensely by his liberation from the obligation of making a war, which he could only sustain by becoming the beggar and drudge of Parliament. So hard had the estates pressed the royal power, now goading it on and now complaining of results, that we have the unique spectacle of a Plantagenet king lying down and refusing to pull the wagon further over such stony roads. But this did not spring from lack of mental courage or from narrowness of outlook. It was a necessary feature in the king's far-reaching designs. He wished, beyond doubt, to gain absolute power over the nobility and Parliament. Whether he also purposed to use this dictatorship in the interests of the humble masses of his subjects is one of the mysteries, but also the legend long linked with his name. His temperament, the ups and downs of his spirits, his sudden outbursts, the almost superhuman refinements of his calculations, have all been abundantly paraded as the causes of his ruin. But the common people thought he was their friend. He would, they imagined, had he the power, deliver them from the hard oppression of their masters, and long did they cherish his memory. The Irish expedition had been the first stage towards the establishment of a despotism. The alliance with France was the second. The king next devoted himself to the construction of a compact, efficient court party. Both Gaunt and his son, and Mowbray, Earl of Norfolk, one of the former appellants, were now rallied to his side, partly in loyalty to him, and partly in hostility to Arundel and Gloucester. New men were brought into the household. Sir John Bushy and Sir Henry Green represented local county interests and were unquestioning servants of the Crown. Drawn from the parliamentary class, the inevitable arbiter of the feuds between the Crown and aristocracy, they secured to the king the influence necessary to enable him to face the estates of the realm. In January 1397, the estates were summoned to Westminster, where, under deft and at the same time resolute management, they showed all due submission. Thus assured, Richard decided at last to strike. Arundel and Gloucester, though now somewhat in the shade, must have considered themselves protected by time and much friendly intercourse from the consequences of what they'd done in 1388. Much had happened since then, and Chief Justice Tresilian, the tutor Burley, and other victims of that bloodbath seemed distant memories. It was with amazement that they saw the king advancing upon them in cold hatred, rarely surpassed among men. Arundel and some others of his associates were declared traitors, and accorded only the courtesy of decapitation. Warwick was exiled to the Isle of Man. Gloucester, arrested and taken to Calais, was there murdered by Richard's agents, and this deed, not being covered by constitutional forms, bred in its turn new retributions. A stigma rested henceforward on the king, similar to that which had marked John after the murder of Arthur. but for the moment he was supreme, as no king of all England had been before, and still his wrath was unassuaged. Parliament was called only to legalise these events. It was found to be so packed and so minded that there was nothing it would not do for the king. Never has there been such a parliament. With ardour pushed to suicidal lengths, it suspended almost every constitutional right and privilege gained in the preceding century. It raised the monarchy upon a foundation more absolute than even William the Conqueror, war leader of his freebooting lieutenants, had claimed. All that had been won by the nation through the crimes of John and the degeneracy of Edward II, all that had been conceded or established by the two great Edwards, was relinquished. And the Parliament, having done its work with this destructive thoroughness, ended by consigning its unfinished business to the care of a committee of 18 persons. As soon as Parliament had dispersed, Richard had the record altered by inserting words that greatly enlarged the scope of the committee's work. If his object was not to do away with Parliament, it was at least to reduce it to the role it had played in the early days of Edward I, when it had been in fact, as well as in name, the King's Parliament. The relations between Gaunt's son, Henry, the King's cousin and contemporary, passed through drama into tragedy. Henry believed himself to have saved the King from being deposed and murdered by Gloucester, Arundel and Warwick in the crisis of 1388. Very likely this was true. Since then he dwelt in familiarity and friendship with Richard. He represented a different element from the old nobility who challenged the crown. These two young men had lived their lives in fair comradeship. The one was king, the other, as son of John of Gaunt, stood near the throne and nearer to the succession. A quarrel arose between Henry and Thomas Mowbray, now Duke of Norfolk. Riding back from Brentford to London, Mowbray voiced his uneasiness. The king, he said, had never forgiven Radcot Bridge, nor the former appellant party to which he and his companion had both belonged. They would be the next victims. Henry accused Mowbray of treasonable language. Conflicting reports of what had been said were laid before Parliament. Each, when challenged, gave the lie to the other. Trial by battle appeared the correct solution. The famous scene took place in September 1398. The lists were drawn. The English world assembled. The champions presented themselves. But the king, exasperating the spectators of all classes who'd gathered in high expectation to see the sport, cast down his warder, forbade the combat, and exiled Mowbray for life and Henry for a decade. Both lords obeyed the royal commands. Mowbray soon died, but Henry, astounded by what he deemed ingratitude and injustice, lived and schemed in France. The year which followed was an unveiled despotism, and Richard, so patient till his vengeance was accomplished, showed restlessness and perplexity, profusion and inconsequence in his function. Escorted by his faithful archers from Cheshire, he sped about the kingdom, beguiling the weeks with feasts and tournaments, while the administration was left to minor officials at Westminster, or ministers who felt they were neither trusted nor consulted. Financial stringency followed royal extravagance, and forced loans and heavier taxes angered the merchants and country gentry. During 1398, there were many in the nation who awoke to the fact that a servile parliament had in a few weeks suspended many of the fundamental rights and liberties of the realm. For some time, they'd had no quarrel with the king. They now saw him revealed as a despot. Not only the old nobility, who in the former crisis had been defeated, but all the gentry and merchant classes were aghast at the triumph of absolute rule. Nor did their wrath arise from love of constitutional practices alone. They feared, perhaps with many reasons not known to us, that the king, now master, would rule over their heads, resting himself upon the submissive shoulders of the mass of the people. They felt again the terror of the social revolution, which they'd tasted so recently in the peasants' revolt. A solid amalgamation of interest, temper, and action united all the classes which had raised or found themselves above the common level. Here was a king, now absolute, who would, as they muttered, let loose the mob upon them. In February of 1399 died old John of Gaunt, time-honoured Lancaster. Henry in exile succeeded to vast domains, not only in Lancashire and the north, but scattered all over England. Richard, pressed for money, could not refrain from a technically legal seizure of the Lancaster estates in spite of his promises. He declared his cousin disinherited. This challenged the position of every property holder. And forthwith, by a fatal misjudgment of his strength and of what was stirring in the land, the king set forth in May upon a punitive expedition, which was long overdue, to assert the royal authority in Ireland. He left behind him a disordered administration, deprived of troops, and a land violently incensed against him. News of the king's departure was carried to Henry. The moment had come. The coast was clear, and the man did not tarry. In July, Henry of Lancaster, as he had now become, landed in Yorkshire, declaring that he'd only come to claim his lawful rights as heir to his venerated father. He was immediately surrounded by adherents, particularly from the Lancaster estates and the all-powerful northern lords, led by the Earl of Northumberland. The course of his revolt followed exactly that of Isabella and Mortimer against Edward II 72 years before. From York, Henry marched across England, amid general acclamation, to Bristol, and just as Isabella had hanged Hugh de Spencer upon its battlements, so now did Henry of Lancaster exact the capital forfeit from William Scrope, Earl of Wiltshire, Bushy, and Green, King Richard's ministers and representatives. It took some time for the news of Henry's apparition and all that followed so swiftly from it to reach King Richard in the depths of Ireland. He hastened back, though baffled by stormy seas. Having landed in England on July the 27th, he made a rapid 3 weeks' march through North Wales in an attempt to gather forces. What he saw convinced him that all was over. The whole structure of his power, so patiently and subtly built up, had vanished as if by enchantment. The Welsh, who would have stood by him, could not face the advancing power of what was now all England. At Flint Castle, he submitted to Henry, into whose hands the whole administration had now passed. He rode through London as a captive in his train. He was lodged in the Tower. His abdication was extorted. His death had become inevitable. The last of all English kings, whose hereditary right was indisputable, disappeared forever beneath the portcullis of Pontefract Castle. Henry, by and with the consent of the estates of the realm and the lords spiritual and temporal, ascended the throne as Henry IV, and thereby opened a chapter of history destined to be fatal to the medieval baronage. Although Henry's lineage afforded good grounds for his election to the crown, and his own qualities, and still more those of his son, confirmed this decision, a higher right in blood was to descend through the House of Mortimer to the House of York, and from this the Wars of the Roses later broke out upon England. The character of Richard II and his place in the regard of history remain an enigma. That he possessed qualities of a high order, both for design and action, is evident. That he was almost from childhood confronted with measureless difficulties and wrongful oppressions, against which he repeatedly made head, is also plain. The injuries and cruelties which he suffered at the hands of his uncle Gloucester and the high nobility may perhaps be the key to understanding him. Some historians have felt that he was prepared not only to exploit parliamentary and legal manoeuvres against the governing classes, but perhaps even that he would use social forces, then and for many generations, utterly submerged. At any rate, the people for their part long cherished some such notion of him. These unhappy folk, already to be numbered by the million, looked to Richard with hopes destined to be frustrated for centuries. All through the reign of Henry IV, the conception they'd formed of Richard was idealized. He was deemed, whether rightly or wrongly, a martyr to the causes of the weak and poor. Statutes were passed declaring it high treason even to spread the rumour that he was still alive. We have no right in this modern age to rob him of this shaft of sunlight which rests upon his harassed, hunted life. There is, however, no dispute that in his nature, fantastic error and true instinct succeeded each other with baffling rapidity. He was capable of more than human cunning and patience, and also of foolishness which a simpleton would have shunned. He fought four deadly duels with feudal, aristocratic society. In 1386, he was overcome. In 1389, he was victorious. In 1398, he was supreme. In 1399, he was destroyed. Chapter 2. The Usurpation of Henry Bolingbroke. All power and authority fell to King Henry IV, and all who'd run risks to place him on the throne combined to secure his right and their own lives. But the opposite theme endured with strange persistency. The court of France deemed Henry a usurper. His right in blood was not valid while Richard lived, nor even afterwards when the lineage was scrutinized. But other rights existed. The right of conquest, on which he was inclined to base himself, was discarded by him upon good advice. But the fact that he was acclaimed by the estates summoned in Richard's name, added to a near right by birth, afforded a broad, though challenged, foundation for his reign. Many agreeable qualities stand to his credit. All historians concur that he was manly, capable, and naturally merciful. The beginning of his reign was disturbed by the tolerance and lenity which he showed to the defeated party. He who had benefited most from the violent spasm and twist of fortune which had overthrown Richard was the least vindictive against Richard's adherents. He'd been near the centre of all the stresses of the late reign. He'd been wronged and ill-used, yet he showed a strong repugnance to harsh reprisals. In the hour of his accession, he was still the bold knight, surprisingly moderate in success, averse from bloodshed, affianced to growing constitutional ideas, and always dreaming of ending his life as a crusader. But the sullen, turbulent march of events frustrated his tolerant inclinations and eventually soured his generous nature. From the outset, Henry depended upon Parliament to make good by its weight the defects in his title, and rested on the theory of the elective, limited kingship, rather than on that of absolute monarchy. He was therefore alike, by mood and need, a constitutional king. Great words were used at his accession. "This honourable realm of England, the most abundant angle of riches in the whole world," said Archbishop Arundel, "has been reduced to destruction by the counsels of children and widows. Now God has sent a man, knowing and discreet for governance, who by the aid of God will be governed and counselled by the wise and ancient of his realm." "The affairs of the kingdom lie upon us," said the Archbishop. Henry would not act by his own will, nor of his own voluntary purpose or singular opinion, but by common advice, counsel, and consent. Here we see a memorable advance in practice. Parliament itself must not, however, be deemed a fountain of wisdom and virtue. The instrument had no sure base. It could be packed or swayed. Many of the parliaments of this period were dubbed with epithets. The good Parliament, the mad Parliament, the merciless Parliament were fresh in memory. Moreover, the stakes in the game of power played by the great nobles were far beyond what ordinary men or magnates would risk. Who could tell that some sudden baronial exploit might not overset the whole structure upon which they stood? As each change of power had been attended by capital vengeance upon the vanquished, there arose in the Commons a very solid and enduring desire to let the great lords cut each other's throats if they were so minded. Therefore the Commons, while acting with vigour, preferred to base themselves upon petition rather than resolution, thus throwing the responsibility definitely upon the most exalted ruling class. Seeking further protection, they appealed to the king not to judge of any matter from their debates, or from the part taken in them by various members, but rather to await the collective decision of the House. They strongly pressed the doctrine of grievances before supply, and although Henry refused to accept this claim, he was kept so short of money that in practice it was largely conceded. During this time, therefore, parliamentary power over finance was greatly strengthened. Not only did the estates supply the money by voting the taxes, but they began to follow its expenditure, and to require and to receive accounts from the high offices of the state. Nothing like this had been tolerated by any of the kings before. They'd always condemned it as a presumptuous inroad upon their prerogative. These great advances in the polity of England were the characteristics of Lancastrian rule, and followed naturally from the need the House of Lancaster had to buttress its title by public opinion and constitutional authority. Thus, Parliament, in this early epoch, appears to have gained ground, never held again till the 17th century. But although the spiritual and lay estates had seemed not only to choose the sovereign, but even to prescribe the succession to the crown, and the history of these years furnished precedents which lawyers of the Stuart period carefully studied, the actual power of Parliament at this time must not be overstated. The usurpation of Henry IV, the establishment of the rival house in the person of Edward IV, the ousting of Edward V by his uncle, were all acts of feudal violence and rebellion, covered up by declaratory statutes. Parliament was not the author or even the powerful agent in these changes, but only the apprehensive registrar of these results of martial and baronial struggles. Elections were not free. The pocket borough was as common in the 15th as in the 18th century, and Parliament was but the tool and seal of any successful party in the state. It had nonetheless been declared upon parliamentary authority, although at Henry's insistence, that the crown should pass to the king's eldest son, and to his male issue after him. Thus, what had been the English usage was overridden by excluding an elder line dependent on a female link. This did not formally ban succession in the female line, but such was, for a long time, the practical effect. On one issue, indeed, half social, half religious, King and Parliament were heartily agreed. The Lollards' advocacy of a church purified by being relieved of all worldly goods did not command the assent of the clergy. They resisted with wrath and vigour. Lollardy had bitten deep into the minds not only of the poorer citizens, but of the minor gentry throughout the country. It was, in essence, a challenge first to the church and then to the wealthy. The Lollards now sought to win the lay nobility by pointing out how readily the vast treasure of the church might provide the money for continental war. But this appeal fell upon deaf ears. The Lords saw that their own estates stood on no better title than those of the church. They therefore joined with the clergy in defence of their property. Very severe laws were now enacted against the Lollards. The king declared, in full agreement with the estates, that he would destroy heresies with all his strength. In 1401, a terrible statute, De Heretico Cumburendo, condemned relapsed heretics to be burnt alive, and left the judgment solely to the church, requiring sheriffs to execute it without allowing an appeal to the crown. Thus did orthodoxy and property make common cause and march together. But the estates of the realm considered that their chief immediate safeguard lay in the blotting out of the eclipsed faction. They were the hottest against Richard and those who'd been faithful to him. Henry might have been able to stem this tide of cowardly retribution, but for a sinister series of events. He and most of his court fell violently ill through something they'd eaten, and poison was suspected. The Welsh, already discontented, under the leadership of Owen Glendower, presently espoused Richard's cause. The slowness of communication had enabled one set of forces to sweep the country, while the opposite had hardly realised what was happening. Now they in their turn began to move. Five of the six former Lords Appellant, finding themselves in the shade, formed with friends of Richard II a plot to seize the usurping prince at Windsor. Recovered from his mysterious sickness, riding alone by dangerous roads, Henry evaded their trap. But armed risings appeared in several parts of the country. The severity with which these were quelled mounted to the summit of government. The populace in places joined with the government forces. The townsfolk at Cirencester beheaded Lord Lumley and the Earls of Kent and Salisbury, the last a Lollard. The conspiracy received no genuine support. All the mercy of Henry's temper could not moderate the prosecutions enforced by those who shared his risks. Indeed, in a year his popularity was almost destroyed by what was held to be his weakness in dealing with rebellion and attempted murder. Yet we must understand that he was a braver, stronger man than these cruel personages below him. The unsuccessful revolt, the civil war which had begun for Richard after his fall, was fatal to the former king. A sanctity dwelt about his person, and all the ceremonial and constitutional procedure which enthroned his successor could not rob him of it. As he lay in Pontefract Castle, he was the object of many sympathies, both from his adherents and from the suppressed masses, and this chafed and gnawed the party in power. Richard's death was announced in February 1400. Whether he was starved, or, as the government suggested, went on hunger strike, or whether more direct methods were used, is unknowable. The walls of Pontefract have kept their secret. But far and wide throughout England spread the tale that he'd escaped, and that in concealment he awaited his hour to bring the common people of the time to the enjoyment of their own. All this welled up against Henry Bolingbroke. He faced continual murder plots. The trouble with the Welsh deepened into a national insurrection. Owen Glendower, who was a remarkable man of considerable education, carried on a war which was the constant background of English affairs till 1409. The king was also forced to fight continually against the Scots. After 6 years of this harassment, we're told that his natural magnanimity was worn out, and that he yielded himself to the temper of his supporters and of his parliament in cruel deeds. It may well be so. His most serious conflict was with the Percys. These lords of the northern marches, the old Earl of Northumberland and his fiery son Hotspur, had for nearly 3 years carried on the defence of England against the Scots, unaided and almost entirely at their own expense. They also held important areas for the king in North Wales. They could no longer bear the burden. They demanded a settlement of the account. The Earl presented a bill for £60,000. The king, in bitter poverty, could offer but £40,000. Behind this was a longer tale. The Percys had played a great part in placing Henry on the throne. But Edmund Mortimer, Hotspur's brother-in-law, had joined Glendower in rebellion, and the family were now under suspicion. They held a great independent power, and an antagonism was perhaps inevitable. Hotspur raised the standard of revolt. But at Shrewsbury, on July the 21st, 1403, Henry overcame and slew him in a small, fierce battle. The old Earl, who was marching to his aid, was forced to submit, and pardon was freely extended to him. Parliament was at pains to absolve him from all charges of treason and rebellion, and declared him guilty of trespass alone. This clemency was no doubt due to the necessities of the border, and to lack of any other means of defending it against the Scots. The Earl therefore addressed himself to this task, which secured his position at the head of strong forces. But 2 years later, with his son's death at heart, he rebelled again, and this time the conspiracy was far-reaching. Archbishop Scrope of York and Thomas Mowbray, Earl of Nottingham, were his principal confederates. The programme of the rebellion was reform, and all personal issues were avoided. Once again Henry marched north, and once again he was successful. Northumberland was driven across the border, where for some years he remained a menace. Scrope and Mowbray fell into the hands of the king's officers, and Henry, in spite of the appeals of the Archbishop of Canterbury, allowed them to be beheaded after a summary trial. Scrope's execution caused a profound shock throughout the land, and many compared it with the murder of Thomas Becket. At the same time, the king's health failed. He was said to be smitten with leprosy, and this was attributed to the wrath of God. The diagnosis, at least, was incorrect. He had a disfiguring affection of the skin, and a disease of the heart marked by fainting fits and trances. He was physically a broken man. Henceforward, his reign was a struggle against death as well as life. He still managed to triumph in the Welsh War, and Owen Glendower was forced back into his mountains. But Parliament took all advantages from the king's necessities. Henry saw safety only in surrender. He yielded himself and his burdens to the estates, with the constitutional deference of a modern sovereign. They pressed him hard, and in all the ways most intimately galling. Foreigners, not even accepting the Queen's two married daughters, were to be expelled. A council must be nominated by the King, which included the parliamentary leaders. The accounts of government expenses were subjected to a parliamentary audit. The King's own household was combed and remodelled by unfriendly hands. The new council demanded even fuller powers. The King pledged himself to govern only by their advice. By these submissions, Henry became the least of kings. But he had transferred an intolerable task to others. They had the odium and the toil. They were increasingly unworthy of the trust. A new figure now came upon the scene. Henry's eldest son, the Prince of Wales, showed already an extraordinary force and quality. He led the charge against Hotspur at Shrewsbury. He gained successes in Wales. It was only after the virtual defeat of Glendower that Prince Henry was free to turn to large political intrigue. As his father's health declined, he was everywhere drawn into state business. He accepted all duties and sought only for more. Pressed by his adherents, principally his half-uncles, the three Beaufort brothers, to take over the government from the failing hands of an invalid, he headed a demand that the King should abdicate in his favour. But Henry Bolingbroke, though tottering, repulsed the proposal with violent indignation. There was a stern confrontation of father and son at Westminster in 1411. The King's partisans appeared to be the more numerous or more resolute. The Prince withdrew abashed. He was removed from the presidency of the council, and his adherents were dismissed from office. He hid his head in retirement. His opponents even charged him with embezzling the pay of the Calais garrison. From this, he cleared himself decisively. But there can be no doubt that the dying sovereign still gripped convulsively the reins of power. Misgovernment and decrepitude remained for a while successfully enthroned. In 1412, when the King could no longer walk and scarcely ride, he was with difficulty dissuaded by his council from attempting to command the troops in Aquitaine. He lingered through the winter, talked of a crusade, summoned Parliament in February, but could do no business with it. In March, when praying in Westminster Abbey, he had a prolonged fit, from which he rallied only to die in the Jerusalem chamber on March the 20th, 1413. Thus the life and reign of King Henry IV exhibit to us another instance of the vanities of ambition and the harsh guerdon which rewards its success. He'd had wrongs to avenge and a cause to champion. He'd hardly dared at first to aim at the crown, but he'd played the final stake to gain it. He'd found it less pleasing when possessed. Not only physically, but morally, he sank under its weight. His years of triumph were his years of care and sorrow. But none can say he had not reason and justice behind his actions, or that he was not accepted by the country at large. Upon his death, a new personality, built upon a grand historic scale, long hungry for power, ascended without dispute the throne not only of England, but very soon, of almost all Western Christendom. Chapter 3.